Hey, podcast listeners, it's Michael Shelley. Well, big news today. We're starting to rerun some of the older things, some of the older interviews I've done as podcasts. They've, of course, always been available over at wfmu.org/Michael, but having them delivered to your device is, I think, a good idea to start hearing some of these older ones. And today we start off with Duck Dunn. It's a real good one, and of course, he's passed away since we did this interview. Just interesting guy, great guy. The Stax music story, so full of interesting stuff, and it so reflects the sort of the cultural change of America during the time Stax existed. Maybe I'm reading into it too much. In any case, I guarantee you, interesting interview, great guy, great music. And of course, the whole show is Stax music, and you can listen to the archive with the music over at wfmu.org/Michael. Now, somebody recently gave me, this is where the commercial sort of comes in, somebody gave me an iPad recently, their old iPad. And so for the first time, I've got this thing in my kitchen, and I'm listening to it usually when I'm preparing dinner for my family, and I'm listening to podcasts. And Gilbert Gottfried is one I listen to, Mark Maron's I listen to Freakonomics, sometimes This American Life. There's a bunch of them. In fact, some listeners made some great suggestions. And one of the things I notice, all the podcasts usually start out with what is basically a commercial. This podcast is brought to you. There's a few that I've heard just hundreds of times. It seems like there's a few people, stamps.com, Squarespace, some other website thing, where they just, you know, you hear these all over and over and over again. Keep in mind, the WFMU podcasts, no commercials. We raise our money one way, and that's from the listeners. We do it once a year for 2 weeks, and we are in the middle of our fundraiser this year. As I mentioned a couple weeks ago, I've created a CD of 18 songs. I had 18 great artists make original recordings of 1970s hits, and it's the third in a series called Even More Super Hits of the 70s, and it's yours with a pledge of $75 or more. You get that, a t-shirt, some stickers, a membership card, discounted record fare admission. It's easy to do. Head over to wfmu.org/Michael, and there's a place for comments. And I, please comment, I am a podcast listener, a podcast supporter. I'd love to announce that this Saturday on my live show when I'll be reading your comments. And, of course, you'll be in the running for some great prizes I'll be giving away, too. If you want to see the video for Super, Even More Super to the 70s, head over to wfmu.org/superhits. The video is really worth watching. It's entertaining. Okay. My first in my rerun series, here is my interview with the great, late Donald Duck Dunn, and I hope this will start a nice series of reviving some of my most favorite interviews, and I hope to hear from some of you during our pledge drive. Thanks so much.
Yeah, there's Hip Hugger. It's just sounding fantastic, certainly to my ears, right here on the mighty WFMU. And joining us on the telephone, Duck Dunn, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Yeah? What do you, you live down in Florida, is that right?
Yeah, right below Tampa, between Tampa and Sarasota, a little town called Palmetto.
Doesn't it get a little hot down there?
About 2 weeks ago, you couldn't even go out the door.
It must be heck on instruments. Must turn them sideways a little bit.
Well... Fortunately, I keep mine in the house, and I got an amplifier in the garage I get worried about every now and then.
Born 1941, Memphis, Tennessee, right in the center of Memphis, right sort of right at the best time to be born, because when you were a teenager, things were kind of going crazy there, right?
Oh, yeah. You had Elvis, Jerry Lee, all that going on, and then Bobby Bland was recording there.
Yeah, sort of home of the blues, Elvis, yeah, Stax, sure. High Records, sure. The Ardent scene. A lot of things were going on. Tell me, as a kid, what kind of music were you guys listening to in the, you know, the mid-50s, early 50s?
Well, when I was really young, I really got burnt up pretty bad. I turned the gas on the stove when I was 2 years old and struck a match, and I got burnt pretty bad. And so I was laid up for the time I entered about the first grade. But my brother, we used to listen to the Grand Ole Opry. He'd rock me and hold me. But when I heard Little Richard and Bill Doggett and Bo Diddley, of course, it just changed my life.
Yeah, was that stuff on normal radio, or did you have to search it out?
No, you had this jockey there called Dewey Phillips.
Right.
And Dewey was just incredible. He played everything from Joe Turner to Elvis to Jerry Lee. He just played everything.
Hmm.
You know, the rockabilly and the R&B.
And did you think, I mean, was there, what do you think the earliest time you thought to yourself, maybe this is something I want to try to get a piece of?
Well, I was a pretty good student until I hit about the 10th grade, and I heard that music, and I think they finally just let me out of high school.
Is that true? Did you never graduate high school?
I graduated, but it took 16 credits, and I think they gave me a quarter of a credit just to get my butt out of there.
Keep it moving. Yeah, you grew up right down the street from Steve Cropper, right?
Right.
And
right.
All those guys, Pacquiao, Stinn, and Wayne Jackson, all those guys were around. I mean, guys you would work with on and off, really, you're still working with a lot of these guys, and you've known them since you were a little kid, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Wayne Jackson and I were born in the same hospital on the same day.
Yeah, amazing. That is truly amazing. Maybe that is one of the secrets to why the Stax sound is the way it is.
Well, I think the secret was Al Jackson Jr., to tell you the truth. I think Al Jackson Jr. was to Stax as James Jamerson was to Motown.
Andrew, you know, that it's something that people talk about, the drummer, of course, of Booker T and the MGs and the Stax house band. People do talk about him as he was just, you know, couldn't make a bad sound, you know?
He's just impeccable. I had a little bad of a rush. I rushed a lot, and he taught me how to, you know, he taught me, he said, "Hey, Dunn, this is music theory." He'd say, "Wait on two. When I play two, you play a line," and that's the best advice I ever got in my life.
Interesting. So you started to play in a band. I understand you started to play guitar, but there were just too many good guitar players around. Is that right?
Too many strings.
Yeah. Bass was
it had six. I did better with four.
And what was your first? I mean, did you sit in your bedroom and play along to the radio, or did you start?
Yeah, I did that, and looked in the mirror a lot, and you know, just. But you about got it right. Sit in the bedroom and play to the radio and. And then my wife and I, well, we've been together since 10th grade, and she was crazy about music as I was. And she when she got out of high school, she worked for an attorney, and I was working for my dad. And we'd probably making $60 a week, but we'd go out and we'd buy Hank Ballard the Midnighters record or an album or a Bo Diddley or Little Richard or just anything that was that I really liked, and I just played them over and over. I wore them out.
And so you're working, and then did you think, well, I'll start this little band in the nighttime, or what was? How did you ease into that?
Well, it started with Steve was working at a grocery store from about three blocks from where we live. And we had this little band together, and there was this club out in Millington, Tennessee, which was actually a naval station. And so on the weekends, a lot of those sailors would go there and drink beer. And we wasn't really good in those days, but we were just good enough to go in and make $10 and all the beer you could drink, I think, and then play. So it was Steve, myself, and Charlie Freeman and Terry Johnson, we kind of started it. And then as time progressed, we put Packy in and then Wayne.
That have sort of evolved into the Royal Spades, who evolved into the Marquees, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So around, you know, about this time, Jim Stewart, Estelle Axton start this little record company, first called Satellite, then Stax. And it seems like in the beginning they weren't quite sure what they were going to do, and then they had a couple R&B hits, and it became definitively an R&B label. And it seems like you guys were just a little bit young, but you were sort of knocking on the door from the very beginning, trying to get in there, and of course, Packy Axon being Estelle's son helped you get your foot in the door there. And you end up, Marquees ends up recording Last Night, which becomes a big hit in 1961. And I believe that you do not play on that record. Is that right?
Well, I played on it. I had played on it. And they went back and they said, well, Jerry Wexler came in, and Jerry said, why don't you put, we didn't have horns on it. So they said, well, put horns on it. And so at the time, my dad was going through some financial stuff, and then he had this little helicopter ride, which he'd take out on weekends and get kids to ride it. He was doing real well with it, but he needed help. And at that time, I was out doing with my dad, and I missed it. So I think Louis ended up playing on it.
Louis Sternberg, who was the first MG's bass player. Yeah, it's funny because there's about 10 different accounts of how Last Night was played and created, and every one of them is different. We'll never know.
Well, I've also heard that there was one segment they used that I was actually on the first half of it, but the second half got erased, and I can't go for that. You hear so many stories, I tell you what, I've heard so many, I don't know what to believe.
Yeah, yeah, I read that story too, that they accidentally erased the first few seconds of and had to go in the garbage and edit it from.
Exactly.
Kind of funny. Now, that song, I believe, produced by Chip Smoman. People sort of forget that Chip Smoman was a part of Stax Records.
Exactly.
I guess he just didn't get along with everybody or with Jim, wanted a piece of the business, whatever. What was early Chip Smoman like? Because he went on to produce a lot of giant hits for folks like Elvis and people. In those days, what was Chip's like?
Chip's is great. He's just a great producer. Hmm. But he just Chip's rather go to a $2 car and he ain't produce a million selling records.
Ah.
But he was a great producer. But I don't know. There was thoughts of he was taking most of the writers and just turning and giving away the artists, which in the long run there are the writers. So that was some discrepancy there, but I wasn't on that end of it at that time. I didn't get in the business end of it with Stax until we started doing the producer's pool, produced by staff, and that was later on. And Al and I still played clubs for about, I can't remember how long.
Well, the Marquees Last Night was a big hit, so the Marquees took to touring, I suppose, and it was,
right.
Who knows
right.
if it was the same guys on the records or not, but at least some folks called the Marquees went out on the road, and apparently that was a crazy, crazy tour, and apparently Packy Axton, from every account I've read, was just a wild man.
Well, he just drank a lot. That was his biggest. That was his biggest problem. He just drank a lot, and I think he had a few problems. He didn't play the lead solo on the record or something, and it just kind of ate at him a little bit. And but he's the sweetest guy ever on the week, but he just loved to drink. And eventually it got him early.
Yeah. You sort of get back to town and you become a big part of the Stax scene. You're playing on sessions like Don't Miss Your Water from William Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And right around that time, 1962, Booker T and the MGs just happens. I think it was just a jam one night of a session. They come up with Green Onions. It's a hit. And so now it becomes a band. And Louis Sternberg was the bass player that day. So he becomes sort of the bass player of
actually,
that band.
Actually, it's Steinberg.
Steinberg, I'm sorry. And so for the next 2 years, he's in Booker T and the MGs. But you're still there and you're still playing on sessions with folks coming through, right?
Right. When Louis was a great walking bass player, like a shuffle bass player, and but for some strange reason, I started playing kind of more syncopated bass, and that kind of came in, and it kind of took over a little bit, and that's when they asked me to come in, and. That's how I actually got started there. Of course I knew Steve and all that, and Steve had quit the road with the Marquees, and he was working there after they ended their relationship with Chips, and Steve took over Chip's job.
Right. The best thing that happened to Steve was Chip's leaving. Yeah, he might still be working in the Satellite Record Shop. Let's talk about the Satellite Record Shop. I find that very interesting. At first, it was just the candy stand of this old theater where they had built the studio. And then
I used to go there. I was a kid there. I grew up there.
Buying records from Estelle Axton.
Right.
What was it like there? First of all, was Memphis very segregated? Could, you know, all kinds of people go into the same record shop?
Well, it was in a black area of town, and it was I guess you'd say 95% black music, because there was a radio station there that Rufus Thomas belonged to. He was a disc jockey with WDIA. And then you had WLOK, which Al Bell was affiliated with. Mm. And that's where Al Bell came from. And that was the music that was sold mostly in there. She didn't sell too many Elvis records, I'll put it that way.
Okay. And so you would go in there and get records. And I heard that you would occasionally pull out sort of an acetate and sort of play it for customers to sort of get before they would release something, to see if folks liked it.
Oh yeah, we did that with WLOK, a radio station down there, because I think if I could remember a few, they took some Sam and Dave stuff down there and played it, and they would call in saying, man, yeah, you know, that's great, and that's where Al Bell came in, and in those days, that was just unheard of.
Yeah, you just make one record, bring it down to a radio station, they'd play it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 1964, you finally joined the MGs. Louie sort of gets. Was that a weird moment when he was?
Well, it was awkward for me, but over the period of years, we went to a bunch of award shows together. Of course, you had to include Louie. Of course, he did Green Onions. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So, but Louie and I became best friends.
Hmm.
And we went to the Grammys when we got this Lifetime Achievement Award, and Louie and I sat together, and we just became best friends, and I guess, you know.
That's nice to hear.
In those days, it was awkward because, you know, I didn't want to bump into him, and because I just got his job, I guess you'd say, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let me remind folks, we're talking to Duck Dunn, bass player of the Stax House Band, and, of course, Booker T and the MGs. Yeah, you can't really argue with Green Onions, one of the best records ever made.
That and Honky Tonk, I think, are the best two instrumentals ever made.
Huh, very interesting. So you're now a part of the MGs and the bass player for Stax, you know, starting around 64 on. What was your day like? Was it just go to the studio in the morning and play all day? And didn't know who was going to walk in the door. How did it work?
Well, that was usually the local artists, the William Bells and the Astors and people like that, Carla Thomas and Rufus. You know, they were all local Memphis acts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the way it started out. But like I say, Al, I actually. My brother and I, my brother Bobby, he was a salesman for King Records, all the old Hank Ballard and James Brown, you know. And Bobby was a salesman there, and he got promoted to salesman, and he was actually worked distributor. So he asked me to come in and do the distributing for him. So that was great for me. I was sitting there listening to James Brown all day long, and Hank Ballard, the Midnighters, and Five Royales, who's that's Steve's favorite guitar player. And anyway, I had access to all that music, and but I'd sneak over and do stacks. We call them demos for $15, and if they got released, we'd get full session pay. You know, but that was the early days before they started really becoming a national hit, you know. Memphis at one point, Stax replaced Cotton as the number one industry in Memphis.
Wow.
And but anyway, that was later on. But Al and I had a club job at night, and I worked with Wayne Jackson, and we worked in a place called the Rebel Room, and later on a place called Hernando's Hideaway. But it was more of a rockabilly. Back in those days, there it was all white clubs, you know. Hmm. And Al worked with Willie Mitchell. Al played drums with Willie Mitchell.
Hmm.
And so, but on my way home, I got off at 1 o'clock, and Al played to 3. But on the way home, I'd stop in, and I knew Al, and I just said, if I ever get to play with this guy, I know he'll make me a better bass player.
Huh.
And it came true.
So let's talk about each guy in that band, Booker T and the MGs. When the four of you guys got together, I mean, every one of you guys brings something special to his or own instrument, yet together it's even more. It's like 25% plus 25% plus 25% plus 25% equals more than 100% somehow, you know? Tell me about Booker T, and he was so young, he was still, I think, in high school, during some of those sessions.
Yeah, well, Booker can play anything. He went to Indiana University, and during high school, his instrument was trombone.
Hmm.
And then, but they, when they did, there was a record called "Cause I Love You," and they needed a baritone sax player. Booker played baritone saxophone, and when he wrote songs with William Bell and Eddie Floyd, I mean that's him playing guitar.
Hmm.
One day he picked up my bass, and I said, "Don't you touch it."
Right.
Booker's maestro. He's just wonderful.
Yeah. And tell me, Steve Cropper, I mean, one of the things, I don't know if everybody realized, Steve Cropper co-wrote, half of those songs that you guys
played. Yeah, Steve, they would go to Lorraine Motel, unfortunately, where Dr. King was shot.
Where it's now a museum.
Uh-huh, yeah. And they had a permanent rental room there. When artists like Eddie Floyd or Otis would come in, Steve, they just go down there and write songs because that was privacy. They had privacy there.
Hmm.
And they'd just get out, and they'd go write for a day, and then they'd bring the songs in. We'd record it, record all day long.
Hmm.
Whether it was good or bad or otherwise.
Was it strictly daytime recording at Stax?
Mostly because Al and I, particularly, and Wayne, when we used horns, or sometimes they overdubbed.
Hmm.
But in the early days, we only had a one-track machine, and so we all had to leave at like 8 o'clock because of nighttime gigs,
Yeah, sure.
And because we wasn't on salary, and eventually, after about 2 years, they said, well, quit your night job. That's the first time anybody ever told me to quit my night job. But anyway, so they put us on salary, and we became, well, that was just Al and I, it wasn't Wayne, because they could always overdub the horns later on.
Hmm.
But Al and I, so we'd go in and we'd cut the rhythm tracks, and a lot of times the horn, more than a lot, probably 85 or 90% of the time, they didn't overdub. They played live.
Hmm.
Because we mainly tried to work from like 10 to about 5, and just like banker's hours.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. 1965, two guys that have been hanging around Stax since almost the beginning, Isaac Hayes and David Porter, sort of it comes together for them when Atlantic sends Sam and Dave down there to cut some sides, and they started a run of great Sam and Dave records that all you guys play on. It's really just, Booker T and the MGs at their height. Great songs, two great singers. Those must have been exciting sessions to play on.
Oh, they were there. Sam and Dave, we always look for. Well, we always had the local artists, which we loved very much. Don't get me wrong. But when we got the artists that Atlantic sent in there, like Sam and Dave and Pickett and Otis.
Hmm.
When Otis came, Otis just made a better musician out of you.
Yeah, nobody has a bad word to say about Otis Redding and about his style in the studio, just an incredibly musical head, and he would get everybody excited, right?
Oh, when he came up with those horn lines, the horns were used to playing whole notes and stops and this, but he'd come in there and he went, ba da 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 da, and the horns looked at each other and said, who is this guy? He changed everybody's life. He made everybody smile, and he made everybody a better musician.
And I understand that he would come in, did he write songs in his head, or did he write on an instrument?
Well, he played a guitar, but he tuned it to an open chord. There's a word they use for that down south, and they call it, I think, Vassapu.
Vassapu.
Yeah, and it's tuned to an open chord. And so all he had to do was just bar the fret, you know, and it would come out of chord, you know. If you want to, you just go to the A fret and bar it, and you'd get an A.
An A major chord. So, I did not know that. So he would come in, I hear, with a sort of a, just one, an idea for a song or just a line, and he just sort of got...
Oh yeah,
start chugging, you know.
Yeah, well, and if it didn't work out that day, they would take it, and if it was a good idea, he and Steve would take it, and turn it into something, you know. And a lot of those songs, when we played the what we call the fade out in those days, you know, records were 2 minutes and 30 seconds long at the longest, you know. And sometimes 2:25, but sometimes we'd play it for 4 minutes, but. What we'd do, we would change it. When we got to what we call the fade out, somebody might, Booker, whether it was Booker, Steve, Al, or myself, Al might change the drum lick, and all of a sudden, you got a new rhythm with a new song. And a lot of songs were written up from fade out lines that we were just jamming on, you know.
Interesting. So during the fade out, you'd come up with the next Booker T's and the MG's hit.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it. Yeah.
That's very interesting. You talked about Atlantic sending people down. They sent down Don Covey. You guys did Seesaw, a couple of things. Wilson Pickett, they sent down Midnight Hour. He was trying to cut records apparently in New York, and it just wasn't happening. Jerry Wexler brings him down there, and there's Midnight Hour. Well, you know, I read a story that Wilson Pickett was so happy he sent each of you guys $100. Is that a true story?
I don't remember. Somebody got mine.
Tell me about Jerry Wexler.
That may be true, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
the good story about In the Midnight Hour was Jerry Wexler was down there, and we had the song, and Pickett and Steve had written the song, but Jerry Wexler said there's a dance in New York called the Jerk. And if you listen to Midnight Hour, it's got that delayed two and da 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 boom, pop da boom, and Jerry was out in the middle of the studio doing the jerk, and so Al kind of put a delayed backbeat to it, and when he saw Jerry doing the jerk, that's where that kind of came from.
Yeah, it's sort of very hard to describe. What is subtly different about that beat, but it is subtly different.
Yeah.
And Midnight Hour is the perfect example of it. What was Jerry Wexler like? Here he is, this guy from New York coming down to Stax to produce the records. Was that a problem, or was he just a sweetheart?
Well, to me, he was a sweetheart. He lived down here before he died, I think last year, and
yeah.
I went to the memorial, and he was just he was just great, and he was sharp as a tack until the day he died. I mean, he remembered everything, and he just Jerry had a secret too, and I think that secret was Tom Dowd.
Tom Dowd, engineer and musical genius himself.
Yeah, exactly. And Tom Dowd did something one day. We were sitting there, and I've never seen done. They wanted to make an edit and splice tape. So he ran the tape backwards, and he punched it, ran a little more backwards, punched it, took a razor blade and cut it out. He did it going backwards.
I
said, now that. That's pretty good ear. I finally figured out what he did. He was listening to the bass drum.
Sure.
That's how he edited.
That's all you need. Well, did you know when you're cutting a record like Midnight Hour that this thing is going to be a smash and 50 years later people are still going to be listening to it? I mean, do you have any idea?
Tell you the truth, I figured In Midnight Hour would. I figured Respect would, and I figured Can't Turn You Loose would. But the one my wife said she remembers most about, she says, when we brought home the record Soul Man, she says, that's a hit. I I brought home a copy of Soul Man and played it, and she said, that's a hit.
Yeah. I was listening to that record. To me, it's your best bass work, because during the verses, you're playing this sort of complicated, syncopated line, and then during the choruses, you're playing one note, you know.
Yeah.
And it's such a great, you know, it just changes the whole thing. It's just a genius. I mean, how long, something like Soul Man, how long did it take to work it up, you know, from hearing, were things presented as a demo, or did someone just work it out?
Isaac was really the genius behind Soul Man, and
Isaac Hayes, and he plays piano on the track, right?
Yeah, that's him playing piano, and he came up with a bass and doon da doon da doon 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 that, and in particular, it's just it's almost Bo Diddley, you know. That's kind of what it is, but. And then you had that moment when on the intro and in the middle. That's where you're talking about. It just goes to the holotonic and go to the next chord. And Steve does his guitar fills.
Yeah.
And Steve did that with that slide stuff that sounds like Steve's playing is done with a Zippo cigarette lighter.
A cigarette lighter. Oh, really?
Yeah.
The play it Steve part.
Yeah. And done with a Zippo cigarette lighter.
I did not know. You talked about producing earlier. A lot of the early Stax records don't list a producer at all, and then some of them say produced by the Stax staff, which was this pool of guys of which you were a part of.
Yeah.
So
that's when they gave us a part of the company, and we were all going to get 1/6 of. I think 10% or something like that, and eventually it did work out with in royalties. It helps in my life now.
Oh, that's great. It's good to know that somebody followed up on that. Let me remind folks, it's Duck Dunn we're talking to today, bass player extraordinaire, and it's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. I'm glad to know that you guys are still being taken care of. So often I talk to people who just say they never have been paid ever, you know? It's the music business is tricky.
Well, don't get me wrong. For the longest, we were paid artist fees of what we signed for in the 1960s. And with the day you sell the CDs and everything, the percentage has gone up so much. But
you were still getting your 1 cent or something?
Yeah, we were, you know. It's good, but it's bad, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You talked about Al Bell. He was a DJ. He worked as a promo guy for Stax, and finally Jim Stewart brought him in as a vice president, and he sort of started the company changing to a road that sort of ended in the company's destruction. It sort of blew up and then got too big for itself and sort of it exploded. But there were still lots more hits to come. Knock on Wood, of course, a giant hit. Carla Thomas's Baby, like you said, Soul Man. 1967, a lot of things happened in 67. You guys go to Europe, and I believe it changes your life. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. We had no idea. We were, Otis replaced Elvis as the number one singer over there. We just never knew that was going on.
The MGs.
We were in the studio all the time.
Right, right. You guys never backed up folks live, but for this trip, you all went over, and it was sort of a review show. Everybody came out. There's some great DVD that just came out on that, and it's really excellent. It's just amazing to see. It seems like, and you guys look like you're really focused and having a great time and just enjoying it. You guys never played out live because you were, you know, because you were too busy in the studio. So did it change things when you got home?
Booker and I love the road, but still, Jim wanted us in the studio. I mean, he wanted to cut a hit a day, and then we just about it. At one point there, we just about did. I love to play for people, and we started touring with Credence. We did a little bit with Credence, and started playing the weekends with Credence, and Paul Simon called me, and I went to New York, and he wanted Booker T and MG's New Bridge Over Troubled Water. And he wanted, and we couldn't get out of the studio, so I was in New York City, and Leon Russell, Elton John was opening for Leon Russell, and I knew Leon from the Joe Cocker days, and Leon had stayed at my house, and I knew Leon real well, so we go down to Fillmore and Fillmore East, and Paul Simon asked Leon what he thought about it, and Paul played him the song, and Bridge Over Troubled, and Leon says, "You don't need me, that's great." he did end up using Larry Nettle, which is a classic, we all know.
Yeah. 1967, you guys also play with Otis at the Monterey International Pop Festival, out of left field, and the crowd again goes crazy.
We had an afternoon rehearsal without amplifiers or anything in a hotel room. Huh. We were just trying to remember what we did from it. It had been a few months since we'd been over to Europe. Hmm. So Otis came out, and of course we did the Respect, and that version of "I've Been Loving You Too Long." And when I don't know if you ever heard it, but he said, "Can you do that one more time, Al?" That was just off the top of the head.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And later that year, of course, Otis dies in a plane crash, Madison,
right,
Wisconsin.
Right.
I can only imagine how. I mean, you talk about no one has a bad word to say about this guy. What was the reaction? How long did it take for people to start functioning again?
It was just incredible. I was talking to people, and I said, "I'm still dreaming about the guy." And the same thing after Al died. I had the same dreams about Belushi, but I just dreamed that he was still alive, and I couldn't get over it. And it was just Otis was just. He wore a halo, man. He changed my life.
Hmm. You talk about Jim Stewart and his desire to sort of have hits cut. Did you feel that pressure on a day-to-day basis? Because you guys were cutting hit after hit after hit. Or was it just still always just go in and do our thing?
Well, yeah, it was a little bit of both. There were days that Jim would sit there with his hand on his chin, and I'd say, and we felt like in the studio, what was coming out of our hands and the musically that he wasn't capturing on tape, and that's when I think they decided to get they went and got Ronnie Capone, an engineer for Stax, and Jim just kind of backed away from that, which was a great thing, because Ronnie was a drummer, and he had great ears, but he was a great engineer too.
Interesting. There was so much going on with soul music in that time, the late 60s, Motown and the Muscle Shoals sound, and the Curtis Mayfield and the Chicago sound, and just across town, Willie Mitchell started having lots and lots of hits. Did you guys listen to those, analyze those, compete with those, or not?
Well, Al was producing most of that stuff over at Willie Mitchell's.
Al Jackson drummed on those Al Green songs and all that.
Incredible
stuff. Yeah, great records. 1968, Isaac Hayes, you co-produced Precious Precious, that great track on him. Worked with the soul singers Johnny Taylor, Who's Making Love, another giant hit.
Oh yeah, we forget about Johnny someday. He seems to never get mentioned. I'm glad you brought him up.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's some great Johnny Taylor records, and that guy could sing. You know, that's a spine-tingling kind of a performance there. And Hang 'Em High, Booker T and the MGs, and 1968, of course, as you mentioned earlier, Martin Luther King assassinated at the Lorraine Hotel. Did that change things?
Of course, it changed things. They had to put guards on the gate there then, and there's some parts of my life that I don't like to get into, because it was just racially motivated, and there was people that I guess that didn't like me because of my color, and the militants kind of got in there, and it wasn't comfortable.
Yeah, it was a strange time for America, certainly, and you know, things that had been bubbling boiled over eventually. And Memphis always, you know, sort of a segregated town, and It's just a weird situation. There's, I don't know if you've ever read that book by Rob Bowman about stacks. It sort of goes into detail on all that. And one of the things that seems almost ironic is that stacks was this tiny little company where blacks and whites worked together, and slowly as it increased and sort of people started noticing it, you couldn't help but noticing it because of the hits, and like you said, just stacks became the biggest business in Memphis, and it sort of brought this attention that sort of ruined what was there.
Well, it was. I think it was due to that a little, somewhat. But I think when we started trying to become a major LP in those days, long playing records, and we started producing albums instead of 40. We always made a 45 hit, and from the 45 hit, we made an album. Hmm. We started making albums without trying to make 45 hits. And I think that's probably that was some of my problems with it. It just seems like a hit album could stem from a hit single, you know.
Not the other way. Yeah, well, there was one point where after you sort of lost your catalog, it's a long story, but Jim Stewart had signed this contract way back with Atlantic, and he didn't understand that Atlantic would end up owning all of Stax, all of that early, I think till 68, all of that Stax. So all of a sudden Stax had no catalog, and Al Bell had the idea to record, I think, 27 albums and release them all at once, so you'd have an instant sort of catalog.
Yeah. I can't even think of the name of the company bought us now, but
I think a Gulf and Western.
Gulf and Western, yeah, exactly. Thanks. And I think that was a big change.
Things got really heavy there.
But see, we never knew the business end of what Jim was doing. All we did was go in and play, and we didn't know what the dealings were with Atlantic. We didn't know there were hard feelings even with Atlantic. So that's why Jerry Wexler and I and Tom Dowd, we and all the musicians just remained best of friends with them, you know.
Yeah. Time is Tight by Booker T. MG's big hit in 69. Things started getting heavy. Isaac Hayes exploded, became as big a star as you could be. Guys were found with bags of money in the airport. I mean, the whole thing at Stax sort of really just got strange, I think.
It got strange, and you know, there was a lot of payola problems, and which I don't know the details of, but I know the accusations and whatever.
Steve Cropper left, Booker T left, you and Al Jackson stayed, try to keep playing on sessions, try to make Booker T work. You played with Bill Withers on the Just As I Am record. What a great record that is.
Mm-hmm.
You also played a session with Elvis. He recorded at Stax a few different days, and I tried real hard to figure out which tracks exactly you're on, but there's not a lot of great documentation. What was Elvis like? I think it's 1973. What was he like then? What were the sessions like?
I went in, and I think I played on either two or three of them. I can't even tell you the name of them. I was just hoping I'd be on a Don't Be Cruel, but that didn't happen.
That would be cool,
but,
yeah.
But during the demos, before he sang, they had an impersonator singing the demos to save his voice, you know. But I talked to the engineer that engineered it. He cooperated or co-engineered with Ellis's engineer and producer, but they said that, you know, it wasn't like an Otis. He almost couldn't even hear him in the studio when he sang, but he just sang so soft, but it came out so strong. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a talented guy, must have been exciting and a little bit of a letdown. And
yeah, it was. It was for me because Don't Be Cruel when I was growing up was one of my favorite songs of all time. And I said, oh man, maybe I won't get to play on a Don't Be Cruel, but just getting to play on a major hit would be incredible.
Yeah.
Nothing better than hearing yourself on the radio.
Well, you must hear yourself every single day. I hear you on the radio every day. You played with Muddy Waters, Rita Coolidge, Ronnie Hawkins, Freddie King, Herbie Mann, Mel and Tim, Dwayne Allman, John Prine, Leon Russell, Rod Stewart, Joan Baez, Richie Havens, Chris Hillman, The Manhattan Transfer, Roy Buchanan, Lee Von Helm, Diana Ross, Billy Swan, Peter Frampton, Tom Petty, Petty, Bob Dylan, Stevie Nicks, Eric Clapton, Boz Scaggs, Crosby, Stills, Nash, lots and lots of people over the years. One stop I want to mention is, well, you brought it up earlier, the Blues Brothers thing. When the phone rang, what was that, about 1976 or 77?
Yeah, somewhere in that area.
Were you surprised?
We had been playing with Levon Helm, and the horn players from the Saturday Night Live show were playing with Levon. Hmm. And so Belushi and Aykroyd wanted to put the band together, and Belushi was, I found out later, that he was a big fan of Stax. And so Tom Malone, the trombone player at Saturday Night Live, he said, well, I know Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper. And so then one morning I got a call from John Belushi, and I was in California and he was in New York, and it was about 3 in the morning. I thought it was an old buddy of mine, Don Nix from the Marquees, you know. Mm. I said, don't be calling here. I said, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And so the story goes, I kind of hung up and I said, that's about BS. But he couldn't let me call back. He said, John Belushi. He wanted to know if I'd come to New York.
That's fine.
I said, I was scared to death because I was that Schaefer and Steve Jordan. He just intimidated me. And my wife said, "You got to do this. She said, "You can do this." So she talked me into doing it. And so I went to New York, and it became great. I hadn't had that much fun since the 67 show, and of course with Eric Clapton.
Yeah, that sure seemed like a lot of fun with John Belushi and that. I got to talk about Al Jackson he got shot in his house, 1975. Greatest R&B drummer ever, I think. And it's sort of, in the Rob Bowman book, it sort of says, you know, it seemed like the police didn't really investigate the whole thing too well.
My brother-in-law was a captain on the police department at the time, and I think they come to figure out that some guy that lived in, he was a running back, I think, for the Cleveland Browns. This is speculation maybe, but he was killed in a bank robbery in Seattle, Washington, and that's why they never figured out. That's who the main suspect was.
Okay. Yeah, that's just such a sad, sad moment. Again, another sad moment. You played that great Bob Dylan tribute at Madison Square Garden and ended up backing up Neil Young sort of right after that. Things never have stopped for you. It seems like you've been as busy as you've wanted to be all these years. Is that right?
It couldn't have been better.
Yeah. And married to the same woman since what year?
We were married in 62.
That's a long time. And you've got a grandkid, right?
Yeah, yeah. He's 3 and a half.
Oh, that's great.
And my son Jeff, my wife and I, we lost a son at 18 in a car wreck.
Huh.
And his name was Michael. Your name? And but my son he said, "Dad, I'm gonna name my son Michael." And I said, I got a little superstitious, and I said, "Well, are you sure you want to do that?" And he said, "Yeah, I want to name him after my brother." So he named him after his brother.
That's very sweet. That's nice. Yeah, being a grandfather's got to be the best, your best production of all, I'll bet.
I tell you what, he jumps in my arms, and I'm sore for 2 days. He's big.
So what's next? What's the story? King the MG is still out there?
Booker's done a solo record, and then I'm glad for him, and then he's out promoting it. But according to our agency, hopefully in the fall we'll get back. And I think we're going back to Amsterdam. We was over there last year, and it was really great for those people. And so I think we're going back over there for a week.
Yeah, I see you guys I've seen you guys a few times, and it's always a fantastic show, you know, always just great. You know, it's amazing to see. And Steve Potts seems to be just the right guy.
He's perfect.
I've seen you with a few different drummers, and he seems to get it the best.
Well, you know, he's actually, I think, a nephew of Al Jackson.
Al Jackson's nephew, oh, all right.
So it's in
the blood, perhaps.
Yeah.
Duck Dunn, I do appreciate you spending time with us. It's just such a great story, and the music is so good. I've got I Can't Turn You Loose queued up here by Otis Redding. Anything we need to know about this record?
Oh, it's just listen to Al and just how he pushes it. I never get over that record. And Otis's voice on singing on that beat the way he does. Hip shaking, mama. I can't do that.
Well, Duck Dunn, thanks. Have a great day. I really appreciate it.
All right, Michael.